This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Gwen Tompkins. Florida is a national model for providing public access to government meetings and records. But state leaders are currently struggling with some new technology. Instant messaging and other forms of communication can be difficult to track, which could take official correspondence offline. Florida Public Radio's Tramell Gomes reports.
Senator Fasano? Here. Senator Lawson?
Florida is embracing the perks of advanced technology. The legislature just started piloting the use of electronic meeting packets instead of printing them on paper.
And I believe everybody received an email that contained a link to the e-packet's location on the internet for quick access and review in advance of the meeting.
Here in this state Senate committee meeting, everything is digital. But another piece of technology is causing concern, the use of cell phones like BlackBerries.
Yeah, that's like my lifeline, you know?
State Senator Mike Fasano is not what you would call an addict. He uses his BlackBerry but believes there's a proper time and place, and during a government meeting is not one of them.
Last year, during a committee meeting dealing with property insurance, there was a senator who was getting emails directed to his BlackBerry instantaneously from a lobbyist in the audience giving him questions to ask of the Office of Insurance Regulation. And that's just, in my opinion, way out of line.
Emails sent from a BlackBerry are easily tracked and archived by government servers. But the wireless devices can also send electronic messages in another way called pinning. And those communications often are not tracked. The practice stirred controversy last summer when staff members of Florida's Public Service Commission were caught exchanging PIN messages with a lobbyist of a utility it regulates.
People need to understand that they cannot use these kinds of modes of communication to conduct official business if they have no way of capturing the record that it creates.
Ann Wiseman is with the nonpartisan watchdog group Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington. She says during the Bush administration, some officials used Republican National Committee email accounts and pin-to-pin messaging to avoid record-keeping. She says states across the country need to be careful.
I'd be inclined to ban the use of BlackBerries during those kinds of proceedings just because of the risk that they could be used for inappropriate or improper ex parte communication.
But Ron Book, a Tallahassee lobbyist, disagrees. He says that's just not possible in this technological age.
Where do you draw the line? Do you draw the line at a BlackBerry, but yet it's okay to bring a personal computer in? Do you limit people to bring a computer in that's a state computer? And how much of that becomes accessible from a public records perspective?
Even though Senator Fasano chooses to leave his phone in his office during meetings, he doesn't believe there should be a ban.
Certainly a lobbyist should not be texting messages or pinning messages to a senator asking him or her to ask these specific questions. If that lobbyist had any courage or guts, he or she would get up there and ask those questions himself before the Senate committee.
Florida law already covers electronic communications, noting any discussion that has to do with public issues is a public record. Open government experts say it just comes down to enforcement and hope that governments can keep up with the changes in technology. For NPR News, I'm Tramell Gomes in Tallahassee.
And all these recalls can make you wonder if a design or manufacturing flaw is about to be announced for your wheels. NPR's Joe Palca has this look at the safety of cars built with complicated electronic components.
We want cars that don't pollute. We want cars that are fuel efficient. But do all the fancy electronics needed to squeeze 40 or 50 miles out of a gallon of gas mean we've compromised on safety?
Absolutely not. There's no silver bullet in that there's no perfect solution for making cars completely safe and the most fuel efficient.
That's Simon Washington. He's director of the Safe Transportation Research and Education Center at the University of California, Berkeley. He says when car makers are faced with trade-offs between safety and fuel economy, safety typically wins. But Washington says the reliance on electronic sensors and computer code presents new challenges to car designers. For example, for more than two decades, engineers have known there are instances when nearby radio transmitters can cause problems for a car's electronics. Washington says it's a problem that's been solved.
It's a matter of finding out what they are and then reprogramming and reconfiguring the electronic components.
Sometimes a little extra shielding is necessary. But Washington says car makers do an excellent job of protecting a car's electronic components. And the way cars are designed, if a critical electronic component does fail, a mechanical system will still be there. Take anti-lock braking systems. A computer tells the brakes the best way to stop the car.
The brakes will function without the computer.
Paul Cuban is an engineering professor at the University of Southern Indiana. They won't function as well because anti-lock braking systems, on average, do better stopping a car than most human drivers, but they will function.
It's gotten to the point where it's hard to separate the mechanical and the electrical designs because they interact with each other.
So a car like the Toyota Prius hybrid is just the next step in a future that's moving toward cars with more electronics, more robotic-type control systems, systems that can analyze driving conditions and act accordingly. In fact, people are already developing autonomous cars, cars that can drive themselves. Sebastian Thrun is one of those people. He's a computer scientist at Stanford University. He says today's cars have begun to use the technology that will someday lead to driverless cars. He understands the reliance on such automated electronic systems can make people nervous.
You feel if there's a systematic failure mode, that machines have a systematic bug, they might actually cause a lot of harm. In reality, however, the statistics don't really justify this.
Thrun says only a tiny fraction of all accidents are caused by problems with the car, and most of those are related to tire failures. The vast majority occur because a human driver did something wrong or simply got distracted.
That's where machines are great. They have amazing reliability to just do the same task over and over again.
And do it without any desire to send a text message or put on makeup while traveling at 60 miles an hour. Red Whitaker of Carnegie Mellon is an expert in robotic systems. He says cars with sophisticated electronics are just the latest step in the evolution of the automobile.
It doesn't matter whether it's first hydraulic brakes or first power steering or first automated braking or first tip-over stability control. At first, there will be tremendous suspicion. There will be great concern.
But then the concern will give way to appreciation. Drivers will come to expect new cars to include technologies that make it easier to navigate while driving, steer with minimal effort, and stop quickly on slippery roads.
And at some point, it's actually unsafe to be driving at the higher speeds in modern highways without some of those features.
Sure, there will be glitches. Car recalls are common. But engineers say overall things are safer, and statistics appear to bear them out. Joe Palca, NPR News, Washington.
Hundreds of thousands of pro-government demonstrators took to the streets of Tehran today to mark the 31st anniversary of the Islamic Revolution. We know this because Iranian state television beamed images of crowds streaming toward a downtown square to hear a speech by President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. Many were carrying Iranian flags and pictures of Supreme Leader Ayatollah Khomeini. But while state television was broadcasting just fine, other forms of communication, text messaging, satellite television, parts of the internet, are reportedly being jammed. In an age of cell phones, Twitter, and Skype, how does a country shut down the flow of information in and out? To help us understand, we're joined by John Pike, director of globalsecurity.org, a news and security website. He's with us on the phone from his office in Alexandria, Virginia. Nice to have you back in the program, John.
Yes, good to be here.
And to that question, John, how does Iran choke off nearly all electronic communications in and out of the country?
Well, if you own the pipelines, if you own the central communications apparatus that all that stuff is going to go through, it's just not that hard to do. And at the end of the day, all of these forms of communications have got to have some way of getting on to the global grid, and all of that's controlled one way or the other by the Iranian government.
So those pipes, those cables are controlled by the government. They go through strict nodes, and there they can be interfered with?
Somewhere along the line, they're going to have to go through a node that the government controls. And it's just not that difficult for the government to decide what's going to get through and what's not going to get through.
Is this similar to what China does from time to time?
Well, certainly the concept is the same, that if you have a government that wants to control what people think, what people see, both inside the country and outside the country, you're going to set into place mechanisms for censorship. I mean, in the old days, all you had to do was control the post office. These days, you also have to control your internet linkage, your teleports to get onto satellites and that sort of thing. But there are people who do this for a living. It's their job to make sure that the Iranian government, like the Chinese government, controls what people see happening in that country.
I was asking about satellite transmissions. Those are controllable as well?
Well, there's not a lot of stuff going via satellite these days simply because of that annoying time lag. Even at the speed of light, it does take a finite amount of time to get up to geostationary orbit and back down again. So most of the sort of communications they would be interested in controlling are going to be going by fiber optic cable, and that does have to go through a central node. And even for satellites, to have a dish big enough to transmit something up to the satellite, that's the sort of thing that the government, one way or the other, is going to control.
And you have to ask a question about why now, after the disputed presidential election last year. There were certainly a lot of images they would have preferred the world didn't see.
Well, I think that they have decided that this has dragged on for far too long, that there was a danger that the demonstrations today would mark a decisive turning point in these political protests. Clearly, they've decided to take harsher measures against the demonstrators than they've taken thus far, and I think they would just as soon not have pictures of that suppression be broadcast around the world.
At that moment, they were the United States government said it was helping Twitter stay on. It was going to shut down for maintenance, I think, and they helped Twitter decide to stay on in order to keep those messages flowing. Are there ways for people outside of Iran, whoever they may be, to work back doors and get information in and out?
Well, certainly there's going to be some seepage. There'll be some leakage. You're going to have videos that have been recorded, smuggled out. So eventually they are going to be able to put the pictures to the words, get some B-roll to form a more dramatic impression of it than simply talking about it today. But that's going to take time, and by then the moment will have passed, and the heads will have been cracked and people will have been rounded up.
B-roll is that imagery that you see on the television news behind whatever the newsreader is saying.
And whatever it is the newsreader is reading. That's the part that's dramatic. To say that there was a person standing in front of a tank in Tiananmen Square is one thing. To see a picture of that person standing in front of the tank is another. And then to see the video of the tank moving is another thing indeed. And it's that dramatic visual impression, not trying to detract from the value of radio, that they're trying to control.
Thank you very much for that last comment, John. Appreciate it. It's also to be noted that most foreign correspondents have been precluded from being inside Iran at this particular moment. John Pike, director of globalsecurity.org, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you so much.
And he joined us today on the phone from his office in Alexandria, Virginia. Tomorrow, it's Talk of the Nation Science Friday with guest Jane Goodall. We'll talk to you again on Monday. Have a great weekend, everybody. I'm Neil Conan. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News in Washington.
Welcome back to All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz.
And I'm Travis Larchuk. And now it's time for our weekly Xbox 360 Live segment.
Travis, I thought we talked about this. And just to reassure the folks listening, we do not have a weekly Xbox Live segment.
Not yet.
Travis Larchuk is one of our producers. And Travis, what are you doing in the studio?
Well, Guy, I came here to play a song for you.
Oh, this is actually kind of nice.
Yeah, this is the song Brazil by the composer Philip Glass. And actually, to be more precise, it's a remix of the song, which was created in a game for the Xbox 360. And I actually brought my Xbox 360 into the studio here with me.
I see it.
And Guy, I understand you've never actually seen one of these before.
That would be incorrect. I have actually seen one at Best Buy.
Yeah, but have you played one?
No.
Well, you've been missing out.
On pretending to be a carjacker or a serial killer? I don't think so. And plus, I like spending time with my family, Travis.
Well, Guy, it's not just about killing people and stealing their cars. There's puzzle games, there's music games, trivia. You can watch Netflix movies through the Xbox.
Well, that sounds a little more promising.
Right. And the game I'm about to show you is called Chime. It came out earlier this month, and I think you'll really like this one.
Okay, so what does it do?
All right. Well, you know that Philip Glass song we just heard?
Mm-hmm.
This game lets you remix songs by well-known artists as you play the game.
Okay, go on.
All right, so have you ever played Tetris?
Yeah, that's a game where you've got these different shaped blocks and they're falling onto the screen and there's Russian music in the background and you have to arrange the blocks into lines.
Yeah, well, it's kind of like that. Here, let me show you. All right, so the basic object here is you're trying to arrange these Tetris-looking blocks into rectangles. And depending on where you drop them, you're remixing this song by Philip Glass.
Okay, so I'm looking at this TV screen now, and I'm seeing a big, empty, white grid. And then obviously we're hearing this music loop.
Right, and I'm going to drop the blocks on different parts of the grid, and just listen to what happens.
Oh, right. So it's triggering different musical notes.
Exactly. So if I put one high up, it'll play a higher pitch note. And if I put one low down on the grid, it'll play a lower pitch note. And if you arrange these shapes into a rectangle, it'll make an even cooler sound. Here, I'll show you.
And all these sounds were actually created by the composer, Philip Glass?
Yeah, that's right. I talked to the guy who created this game. He's with the UK game developer Zoe Mode. His name's Kieran Walsh.
Everything you're hearing comes from the original song. So there are phrases like flute phrases and percussion phrases, all sorts of different parts that we've pulled out. And you might hear them in the original in one place, but you hear them combined with a completely different part of the piece when you hear them in the game.
So there are 5 different songs you can remix in this game, and each song is a different level that gets harder as the game goes along, and each one's by a different artist.
Okay, so let's hear another one. Who do you have?
All right, well, this one is the song Oh Yeah by Moby. Yeah.
Okay, I'm hearing a computer voice that seems to be saying, oh yeah.
That's right. Unlike the Philip Glass song, which is instrumental, in this level, you really get to play with the vocals. So here's Kieran Walsh again.
We really picked out the vocals as an interesting thing for you to play with and trigger. You know, you can take a vocal phrase and you can transpose it, so you hear the same phrase at different pitches. What that gives you is a kind of mosaic effect of all the different phrases.
I mean, one of the really cool things about this game, actually, is that all the people who worked on it and all of the artists whose music are in it gave their work for free because the proceeds of this game actually go to charity.
A charity, I gather, to rehabilitate video game addicts?
No, it's for Save the Children and the Starlight Children's Foundation.
How do you get this game?
Well, you can download it through the Xbox for $5.
That is one of our producers, Travis Larchuk, who, believe it or not, was actually paid to play video games this past week. Travis, thanks.
Thank you, Guy. And by the way, I was carrying my Xbox through the hall, and I heard this rumor that Daniel Shore is a huge Xbox fan.
That would be a false rumor.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Alyssa Block, and it's time now for All Tech Considered. They call it the Black Hat Conference, a meeting held every year to talk about cybersecurity. These days, corporations and governments are worried, really worried, because cyber attacks are growing by the day. And as Nate Plutzik reports, the bad guys are getting smarter and more ambitious.
Jeff Moss is a renowned security expert. He founded the Black Hat Conferences with hopes of bringing together experts to combat the growing threat of malicious hackers.
We're looking into the future. What are the security researchers and hackers doing today? Why are they doing it today? And where is that leading?
Hacking is taking apart electronics to understand how they work. Malicious hackers can use their skills to digitally steal a person's identity or private information. Mike Bailey is a security expert at Foreground Security. He gave a presentation on hacks he found in several social media websites.
Some of the sites that I found these kinds of things on include Twitter, Facebook, Yahoo, Gmail, PayPal, Apple, Microsoft. The list goes on and on. And I mean, these aren't small websites. Frankly, these people have good security teams.
Bailey says that many of these attacks are not difficult to do. For example, a software glitch he found on Facebook could allow a malicious hacker to take over your profile and pretend to be you.
It just required them viewing my webpage, and it would compromise their Facebook account. In this case, it read out the contents of their inbox and sent them to my server. Honestly, I could do anything. I mean, anything you can do with your web browser to Facebook, I could do through you.
Moss says the problem is that often these findings are ignored by corporate or government officials who don't want to hear bad news. They ask,
why couldn't you have just told us about the problem? It's like, well, we did, but you didn't believe us. That's a problem with corporate America. That's a problem with the government.
Andy Freed worked as a federal agent for 26 years. He thinks law enforcement has been largely ineffective at solving the crisis.
My analogy was always that I felt like a sheriff on a horseback trying to catch speeding Ferraris. We know what they're doing, we just can't get there fast enough. So realizing that what works well if all the criminals were in the U.S. doing things to U.S. citizens doesn't work so well when the criminals are from Eastern Europe attacking U.S. citizens.
Jeff Moss says cyber attacks are becoming much more sophisticated.
The bad guys now have a budget. They've got a staff. They've got a mission statement. This is a business to them. And they'll send people to schools, they'll send them to training. They treat this as a business.
Freed and others first started to attend Black Hat to meet helpful hackers who could give them insight into these increasingly complex cyber attacks.
You know, as a law enforcement officer, I wanted to meet people so that when I needed help, I had somebody to reach out to. I mean, there are some hardened bad people out there that we need to be targeting.
Moss hopes Black Hat conferences will provide a place for helpful hackers and security experts to get together to stop these threats, but he isn't sure that the problem will go away.
We don't ever really kill the old problems. What happens is things are moving so quick on the internet. Things are getting updated. New things are coming out. We tend to just sort of tamp down the fire and move on to the next thing. The world is creating technologies faster than we can secure them, faster than we can even comprehend how they're going to be used.
Black Hat conferences are spreading around the world. Later this year, they'll be held in Barcelona, Abu Dhabi, and Las Vegas. Moss hopes the conferences will help security posses catch up with the fast-moving hackers. For NPR News, I'm Nate Plutzik.
And now to the hacking standoff between Google and China. After Google threatened to pull out of China last month, the Chinese government has shown some initiative in cracking down on cybercrime. News broke early last week that Chinese authorities shut down a large-scale hacker training operation in an effort to increase cybersecurity. Well, joining me with an update on the Google China story and other Google news is Omar Gayaga. He's the technology culture reporter for the Austin American Statesman. He talks with us most Mondays. Welcome back, Omar.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
And tell us about the latest in this high-stakes back and forth between Google and China.
Well, last month, after these hacker attacks happened, we heard some very strong words from Google. They were threatening to pull out of the country. But on Friday, Sergey Brin, one of Google's co-founders, spoke publicly about it at the TED conference, a big tech conference, and said that the company is actually pretty optimistic that they will continue to do business in China. Google is being very closely watched on this because if they do make any progress, if they are able to break through any of the censorship constraints that have been made against them, that this would be obviously huge for businesses that want to do business in China. But Google is also calling on other companies that have been hacked to step forward and kind of stand alongside them in letting the world know what's going on with this.
Now, Omar, Google also made news with a high-speed internet service they're working on. It's a 1 gigabit per second fiber optic network. Omar, what does 1 gigabit per second mean? What does that translate to?
Well, it's very, very fast compared to what most people have. Most of our broadband internet tops out at around 10 to 12 megabits per second. This would be about 100 times faster. And the most basic DSL offerings are about 1 megabit per second. So this is 1,000 times faster than that. So this is looking very far forward to web applications that don't even exist yet. Google is looking at sort of the next generation of video and HD, and it's going to be very limited in its availability, at least at first.
Well, who would have access to it?
Google has put out a call to municipalities to kind of nominate areas that would get this, but it's looking like it's only going to be about 50,000 to maybe 500,000 people will get this service at first. We've already seen Seattle, Pittsburgh, the mayors of those cities have put in a request to kind of look into this and try to get Google's attention. Here in Austin and in Round Rock, we've got some people talking about that as well. So places with a lot of techies are going to want to get Google's attention and see if they can be first in line for that very, very high-speed internet.
And last bit of Google news today, Omar, Google has been taking some heat for a new social networking feature called Google Buzz, which debuted last week. It's linked to your Gmail account. It lets you upload videos and share links and chat with your followers. But there's a problem. What's the problem?
The problem was that it was rolled into Google's Gmail service, which is very popular. I think it's something like 176 million users. So this just appeared in people's Gmail inboxes and automatically sort of put the word out there of, hey, you know, here's my Picasa web albums. Here's my Google Reader items that I'm sharing. Here's the people that I email back and forth with before people had a chance to go in there and sort of set those privacy controls to kind of hide that. So over the weekend, Google has made quite a few changes. They're making it more of an opt-in system now. But I think the real issue is that in people's inboxes, they sort of expect some modicum of privacy, and all of a sudden there's this social networking thing that just pops up and puts things out there.
Seems odd that Google wouldn't have anticipated that.
Yeah, it seems to me like Google is taking a page out of Facebook's playbook where they sort of introduce something and don't really let people know about it, and then all of a sudden everyone gets mad, and then they kind of back away a half step and make changes to make it a little more palatable. But to me, Google Buzz, as well as the Nexus One phone that they rolled out last month, these are all ways that Google is sort of getting all up in our business. They're really trying to integrate themselves more closely into our lives beyond search. I don't know if you saw their Super Bowl commercial, Parisian Love, where you see a person fall in love and have a baby all through their Google searches. To me, the fact that Google even ran a Super Bowl commercial says that they really want to get into these consumer spaces, that they really want to really integrate themselves more closely into our lives. I mean, for some people, that's a little scary. For some people, that's very exciting because Google certainly has the mojo to make a lot of big things happen.
Omar, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me. And we'll be talking about all these things on the All Tech Considered blog at npr.org/alltech.
Omar Gayaga is the technology culture reporter for the Austin American Statesman and for All Tech Considered. This is NPR News.